Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Author Sherilyn Kenyon wrote, "The wealth of a soul is measured by how much it can feel, its poverty by how little." In researching this case, I've often wondered if Texas millionaire Cullen Davis even has a soul. He was not the favored of his father's three sons, but he got an equal share of the kingdom. The Davis oil empire crossed continents and made the kind of money that most of us cannot even fathom. And of the three sons, Cullen was the most conspicuous. He wore his wealth like a suit of armor, and he needed a certain kind of woman on his arm to complete his idea of wealthy manliness. She needed to be a blonde bombshell. His first wife was a beautiful woman who his parents approved of, popular and respected in Fort Worth. But she was not a bombshell, and he bored of her quickly. When Cullen left his first wife for a beautiful and flamboyant woman named Priscilla, the city of Fort Worth was scandalized. Priscilla was not a part of the Fort Worth elite, and she had no intention of trying to fit in. Petite, blonde, and busty, she was exactly the bombshell Cullen wanted. Together, they made a huge splash in Fort Worth society. Every year of their marriage, they became more ostentatious and even more scandalous, especially once Priscilla filed for divorce. But the events of August 2nd, 1976 are what D Magazine dubbed the biggest goddamn thing to happen to Fort Worth since the railroad. Welcome to episode 80, The Saga of Cullen and Priscilla Davis, part 1. Cullen Davis and Priscilla Wellborn were both still married to other people when they headed to Acapulco to celebrate the 1968 New Year. Tanned and basking in that glow of new love, they returned, stepping off a plane in Dallas in the dark on January 2nd, 1968. You know that glow, when a new couple can't keep their hands off each other. And someone was watching them. As their Pontiac glided through the foggy drizzle towards Fort Worth, someone was following them. Actually, two cars followed discreetly as the couple checked into the Green Oaks Inn, an infamous Fort Worth hotel that hosted many celebrities. Elvis Presley stayed there in 1974 when he performed at the then Tarrant County Convention Center. It was later demolished for office space in 2007. Cullen went to the front desk and got their room key as Priscilla waited. She was reportedly laughing as she took Cullen's arm and they made their way to their room on the next floor with a view of the swimming pool. This was Cullen and Priscilla's favorite hotel, and they stayed there often. Both were separated from their spouses, and Priscilla would later claim to D Magazine that the divorces had actually been filed months ago. But maybe Jack Wellborn and Sandra Davis wanted some photographic evidence to sway a judge in their favor for custody of their respective children. Priscilla and Cullen undressed, and according to author Mike Cochran, Priscilla was completely nude and Cullen was in his boxer shorts when men kicked down the doors and flashbulbs started popping, startling and temporarily blinding the couple. Priscilla raced to the bathroom and locked the door as Cullen yelled, "You can't do this." According to Cochran, Priscilla screamed through the door that she would call the police. And her husband said, "Open the door and I'll hand you the phone." Sandra, Cullen's spurned wife, reportedly walked in then and said, "Cullen Davis, you dirty son of a bitch," before she stormed out of the room. Mike Cochran agrees that the Green Oaks episode, as he said it was called, did accelerate the two divorces, though I believe Sandra Davis was still trying to hold on to her husband before this incident. And Sandra would remain in love with Cullen throughout his marriage to Priscilla and coming trials, openly telling reporters that she was the only one who really understood Cullen, and she was the only woman he ever really loved. But I don't think Cullen Davis was actually capable of love. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Normally, I like to take you through the history of a particular city, but I featured Fort Worth before, specifically in my 46th episode, Patricide, Thy Name is Marie. Cowtown really doesn't need much introduction to many people anyway. It was originally the king of the cattle industry, before the oil boom made it one of the wealthiest cities in Texas. It's a part of the Dallas-Fort Worth-Arlington metropolitan area. The city is located between two of the biggest oil gusher discoveries in Texas, and is home to several refineries. Those, along with many natural gas wells, made Fort Worth a major player in the oil and gas industries. Incidentally, if you haven't listened to episode 46 on the bizarre case of Marie Robards, who poisoned her own father, I do recommend it as one of my favorites. But let's get back to what is probably Fort Worth's most infamous case. Thomas Cullen Davis was born on September 22, 1933, to parents Ken and Alice Davis. Ken Davis had come to Fort Worth after the crash of 1929 during the Great Depression. Ken Davis was a native of Pennsylvania, the birthplace of the petroleum industry in the United States. He joined a Fort Worth oil field supply firm that was struggling, and within a year, he was able to buy controlling interest in the company with $5,000. That's the equivalent of about $77,000 in 2020 money. To say Ken Davis was a shrewd businessman is an understatement. In a detail that illustrates the old saying that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, when Ken Davis bought controlling interest, it was owned by a widow named Alma Holmes. 12 years later, she threw herself out of her apartment window. By 1978, it was revealed that a failed romance with Ken Davis is what drove Alma to suicide. And by 1978, the company, Midcontinent, and its subsidiaries was exclusively owned by the Davis family, with revenues exceeding $1 billion a year. That would be almost $4 billion today. Ken Davis Sr. had come to Fort Worth with his wife Alice and baby son, Ken Jr. 8 years later, Cullen was born, and then 2 years after that, their youngest son Bill was born. Ken Jr.'s early days weren't in the lap of luxury. He remembers working on his father's farm, baling hay, chopping cotton, a lot of manual labor. But by night, Ken Sr. loved to talk business with his oldest son. By the time Cullen was born, Ken Sr. was a rich man, known to not only be hardworking, but somewhat hard-hearted. His employees did not remember him fondly. Cullen told author Mike Cochran that Ken Sr. treated his employees fairly, but he also said he treated his sons like employees. But they still enjoyed a lifestyle much different than most children. Instead of sending them off to summer camp, Ken Sr. made his own camp on a 50-acre piece of land on Eagle Mountain Lake. He had it built exclusively for his sons, who learned, among many athletic feats, to ski and sail. But even though he had the money to send his sons to just about any prestigious college, all three Davis boys went to Texas A&M, a public university, and though a good school, it was much more modest than his sons might have wished. But he wanted his sons to be modest. Like a lot of self-made men, he didn't want them coddled by his fortune, though they were obviously going to inherit incredible wealth. He also raised his sons to be competitive, both in business and with each other. It is said that Ken Davis Jr. was his father's favorite, and Bill was Alice's favorite son. Cullen, the middle child, didn't do much to deny this. He agreed with most accounts that his mother was a kind woman who saw to it that her sons went to church. But he told author Mike Cochran, quote, "She was like any other woman. She bitched a lot." When Alice died of heart disease in 1967, at the hospital, she was told Cullen was there. She said she didn't want to see Cullen and to call Bill. When Bill got there, she handed him all of her jewelry. She had also refused to let her husband accompany her to the hospital, but more likely because he was already wheelchair-bound. He had had two strokes and a heart attack already himself. After her death, Ken Sr. shut himself in her bedroom until his own death 18 months later. By the time Ken Sr. died in 1968, Mid-Continent was now part of Ken Davis Industries, which had a presence on six continents, known as the world's largest fleet of oil well supply companies. There were over 40 companies, but there were four cornerstone companies that held the empire together, Mid-Continent being the largest, along with Cummins Sales and Services, Great Western Drilling Company, and Stratoflex, a company that Ken Sr. was said to have formed out of spite with a competing vendor he had used that made flexible hose assemblies and fittings. When Ken Sr. died, his will stipulated that his heirs receive an undivided one-third of his holdings, with the understanding that Ken Jr. held the most power. He was the chairman of the board and ranked above his brothers, though he left them free to run their own pieces of the business as they saw fit. For the next 5 years, Ken Davis Industries only became more powerful and diversified, getting into construction, agriculture, timber, aerospace, transportation, and many other types of companies that were essential to a more modern world. Ken Jr. was said to be a man of vision, mirroring his hardworking father, who didn't just look to the next year, but to the next decade. Whereas his brother Cullen was flashy, but sharp. In the beginning, his personal life ran as smoothly as his business ventures. He married a popular Fort Worth native named Sandra Masters in August of 1962. She was a beautiful and curvy woman, much like his next two wives. Unlike them, she chose to keep her auburn hair colored dark. It is rumored that she had breast augmentation surgery, like his other wives, though. As I said in the opening, Cullen had a particular taste in women. He liked them blonde and busty, and if they weren't born that way naturally, he saw to it that they became that way. Cullen and Sandra had two sons, Thomas Cullen Jr. and Brian Keith, before their six-year marriage imploded. Before their divorce was finalized, she had called him tyrannical, harsh, unkind, and cruel. She would change her tune in later years. While married to Sandra, Cullen met Priscilla Wilborn on the tennis courts of the Ridgely Country Club. Priscilla later claimed that they played couples tennis with Cullen and Sandra, and that she and her partner handily won. Priscilla had now caught the millionaire's eye. 5'2" tall, she was tiny but curvy. She would also later undergo breast augmentation surgery at Cullen's urging, but she was already a bombshell when she met Cullen. She was also a natural brunette, but dyed her long hair a soft blonde color. It would go more platinum blonde during her marriage to Cullen. Priscilla was born in Dublin, Texas on July 30th, 1941. Her full name was Priscilla Lee Childers. Her early life is often described as destitute and emphasized that she came from the wrong side of the tracks. She denied this to Texas Monthly magazine. Though her father had left the family when she was still a baby, she said her mother had a degree and always had a job. But in D magazine, out of Dallas, Texas, she herself emphasized her poor upbringing, claiming that she got a quarter a day for a ham sandwich and had to choose between that or a pack of cigarettes. She said she usually just stole her mother's cigarettes. Incidentally, both of these articles came out in March of 1977, before Cullen's trial. I think things like this didn't help her later character assassination in court. She could be proud, but she could also be painfully candid. She told D Magazine that she had been raped at the age of 15 and that the man who did it left on a train mouthing the words, "I'm sorry." She then tells of how she got pregnant at 16 and married the father, Jasper Baker, who had, quote, just returned from overseas. It's almost as if she is hinting he is the one that raped her, as she had stated that her rapist had left on a train to join the army. That marriage produced her daughter, Angela D, who always went by D, before Priscilla divorced Jasper for cheating on her. She briefly moved to California, but moved back 10 months later and met and married used car dealer Jack Wilborn. He was 40 years old and she was 18. They had two children together, a son named Jack, called Jackie, and her youngest daughter, Andrea. Priscilla would later say that Jack Wilborn was easygoing and good to her, but she was bored. At age 19, she was arrested for shoplifting and charged with felony theft of over $50. D Magazine dug up this tidbit, and she explained that she was holding another girl's bag, and it wasn't really her that shoplifted. It was later reduced to a misdemeanor with a $50 fine. Suffice it to say, Priscilla was a contradictory woman who did little to help her own self-image. I am most certainly not blaming her for what would eventually happen, but her willingness to speak to the press, I think, in the end, didn't help her cause at all. Cullen would later say the attraction between him and Priscilla was immediate and electric, while she characterized it as him clumsily flirting, like a boy pulling on a girl's ponytail. However it happened, they soon began a very passionate affair. As I said before, both claimed that they had been separated and that their divorces filed long before they started dating, but that's not exactly true. Sandra had no intention of giving up Cullen, even though she was unhappy in the marriage and technically separated. She still hoped for a reconciliation. But when Jack Wilborn found out about the affair in June of 1967, he filed for divorce 4 days later. He wanted full custody of their children, including Dee, whom he had raised as his own. This is probably what led to the scene at the Green Oaks Inn after New Year's in 1968. Jack wanted pictures showing Priscilla in a bad light, and therefore as a bad mother, and he wanted to prove to Sandra Davis what was going on. It worked. Cullen and Priscilla began openly dating as they waited on their divorces to be finalized. Ken Davis Sr. was still alive when his middle son filed for divorce and started dating Priscilla, and he was not at all happy with Cullen's choice for a second wife. He did not believe that Priscilla was socialite material, which by that stage of Ken Davis Industries was crucial to their public image. Cullen's divorce from Sandra was finalized on August 5, 1968. He married Priscilla 3 weeks later on August 29th. It raised eyebrows for so many reasons, but first and foremost, because it was also the day his father died. Cullen would later insist that he had decided days earlier to marry Priscilla. Priscilla always backed him up on this claim, and their marriage license was obtained 3 days before his father's death. They both felt that while it was unfortunate, they decided not to postpone the wedding. She said, quote, "We decided the next few days would be very hectic and we might as well go ahead." She later said it was only awkward because when someone would offer condolences to Cullen, he would answer them with, "Have you met my wife, Priscilla?" Even if it is true that the wedding was planned for that day, I believe it shows how little regard Cullen had for his own father. He knew he was not the favorite. And I think Priscilla was under no illusions about what Ken Sr. thought of her, so she didn't care much about how it looked either. They also immediately moved into his father's home on Rivercrest. Cullen again defended this, saying he discussed it with his brothers, and he and Priscilla only wanted to protect the empty home from vandals. Besides, Cullen had a great mansion planned. Many reports would say he built it for Priscilla, but he claimed he had wanted to build it for years, even when he was with Sandra, but his father disapproved of that sort of decadent spending. He and Sandra had lived in a modest home not far from his parents. Cullen had dreamed of a palatial hilltop mansion overlooking the Colonial Country Club. And his dream came true. He built a huge mansion worth $3.8 million on 180 acres right outside of Fort Worth. Adjusted for inflation, that would be about $25 million today. Naturally, Priscilla said he did build it for her. While geometric and almost plain-looking from the outside, it was extremely ostentatious on the inside. There was a huge glass-walled indoor pool, a game room with foosball and billiard tables. Priscilla's bathroom was huge, bigger than many of the bedrooms, and styled hot pink with a huge marble tub and crystal chandelier. The walls inside were high and angular and mostly white. Oil paintings, mainly original works from the 19th century, decorated the walls in ornate gold frames. There were statues on pedestals everywhere, including one in the kitchen of a woman with large breasts. It was labeled, "Think Big." There were dozens of jade pieces and other carvings in chrome and glass cases. In the paneled study were all kinds of valuables, and featured prominently on Cullen's desk was a photograph of Priscilla sitting on Cullen's knee, posing in front of the Grand Canyon. The frame was trimmed with real leopard skin. On one wall of their living room was a portrait of Cullen and Priscilla that was more like a mural, depicting them in various poses. I'll have that posted on my social media, along with any other photos I can find. And for her part, Priscilla took to her new wealth like a duck to water. She began spending lavishly, and Cullen was always giving her new jewelry and furs, one time joking that he was about 8 years ahead on anniversary gifts. They took trips all over the world, often on a moment's notice. Paris, Rome, Holland, South America, and West Berlin, to name a few. Cullen even gave her a charm bracelet featuring a small globe with a diamond for each place they had traveled. But perhaps her most famous piece of jewelry, and admittedly one of her own favorites, was a necklace that spelled out "rich bitch" in diamonds. She wore it proudly everywhere, from honky-tonks to high society functions. She gave no shits what other people thought of her. At least that is what she always said. She also said that when they weren't traveling the world, she preferred quiet nights at home watching movies than the Fort Worth social scene. By now, while Ken Jr. mostly looked away, Bill Davis was incensed. He was convinced that Cullen's lavish spending on his new wife depended on corporate funds he used to secure private loans. But Cullen and Ken Jr. disapproved of Bill, who was reportedly a womanizer that drank scotch for lunch and slept with company secretaries. Ken Jr. quietly put a stop to Cullen's misappropriation of funds while the mansion on the hill was still being built. And he more and more sided with Cullen in disputes with Bill. Both Ken Jr. and Cullen inherited their father's famous work ethic. I think it is fair to say they were offended by Bill's management style. Bill and his top management team usually went to the club at lunch, not just for scotches, but to conduct business for the rest of the day. Whereas Ken Jr. and Cullen spent long hours at the office. With their different work models, the three brothers decided to abandon the unanimous vote doctrine for company policy. Now, two concurring votes could overrule one brother. And in the summer of 1973, Ken Jr. and Cullen used this to push Bill out of the power structure of the main company. He still had his own holdings, but for all intents and purposes, he was not a part of the empire or family, as author Mike Cochran put it. There is a fabulously trashy TV movie based on the Cullen Davis case, It's called Texas Justice, and I found a shaky copy on YouTube. It features Heather Locklear as Priscilla, which is ironic, as one of her biggest starring roles was on the old ABC TV show Dynasty, which was rumored to rival the CBS show Dallas. The Davis Brothers saga, supposedly, is what inspired the TV show Dallas, with three oil tycoon backstabbing brothers. And the TV movie is everything you want in trash TV. It was made in 1995, and of course, while exaggerating much of the story, it actually gets quite a bit of it right. This was at the height of Heather Locklear's Melrose Place fame, so she was a fantastic choice to play Priscilla. The Davis brothers and their divided loyalties aren't touched on as much in the movie. It's really about Cullen's later crimes. But in one fictional scene, one of the brothers compared Priscilla to leaving a Christmas tree up all year. While it's nice at first, eventually, it just doesn't go with the decor. Priscilla just didn't fit. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from one of our sponsors. Most hair product companies don't really get you. They generalize hair needs for the masses. That's why I love Prose. Prose makes truly personalized shampoo and conditioners. Prose knows there is more to products than a general hair type. They have given over 1 million consultations with their in-depth hair questionnaire, which is how I got started. I live in a state with high humidity, so my hair tends to frizz a lot in the warmer months. But Prose considers the seasonal changes in my area too. I didn't just describe my hair type in my consultation. I gave my zip code. With their algorithm and over 50 billion formula combinations, Prose was able to determine the unique blend of ingredients to treat my exact concerns. It's a dry season in Tennessee right now, so Prose sent me a pre-shampoo mask, which I used before I shampooed to target my scalp and top hair needs. Then I got a personalized shampoo formulated to consider not only my natural hair needs, but also my salon coloring. My hair felt so soft and yet fuller after this treatment. It feels healthy. I love what Prose sent me, but if I hadn't, they would have allowed me to return the products without question. So get started today with Prose, the healthy hair regimen with your name all over it. Get a free consultation and 20% off your first order. Go to prose.com/southernfried. That's prose.com/southernfried for a free consultation and 20% off. Within 2 years of marriage, there were signs of trouble. A friend of the couple, as well as Cullen's niece Kay, would later blame it on the mansion. Once they were in it, they were rooms apart. I think that is more metaphorical than anything. Priscilla said Cullen began to withdraw sexually, which surprised her. She never thought he was actually cheating, but she was hurt by his coldness and always said she was truly in love with her husband. Even Ken Jr. came to like his sister-in-law and told author Mike Cochran that he thought the old man would have grown to like her for her moxie. Cullen said she was an ingratiating and charming woman who emanated affection. Along with her sexiness and brazen personality, this is what he loved at first. But it became what irritated him about her. As for Priscilla, she claimed Cullen had some strange sexual proclivities. She said that as they traveled the world and other countries, Cullen always wanted to see exotic sex shows that were illegal in the States, as in going to see a donkey show in Mexico. She accompanied him and claimed that she was even once invited along with her husband to partake in a threesome on stage. She said that Cullen was the one that said no, that it would open Pandora's box, but she insisted that she would have declined anyway. But Cullen was a bit of a provocateur. He once rented a van full of booze and food and invited his friends to come in and watch a private screening of the band porno flick Deep Throat. Texas was one of the first states to win an obscenity charge against the film, and it was banned from being shown in the state. Eventually, a Supreme Court judge ruled the film obscene and sanctioned the producers $100,000. But the ruling only fueled the film's popularity, making it one of the most popular X-rated movies of all time. At the time, it was what was called porno chic, and many celebrities not only admitted to watching it, but defended it. In later years, Linda Lovelace, the star, would claim abuse and that a gun was held to her head while filming. Though others involved in the production would deny this point, they did say that her husband and production manager did abuse her. In the documentary, Inside Deep Throat, filmmakers say that bruises are evident on her body. The phrase Deep Throat would become even more widely known when a secret Watergate informant was nicknamed Deep Throat by the Washington Post reporters who broke the scandal. Anyway, I think this shows a side to Cullen that isn't often talked about. People like to focus on what a floozy they thought Priscilla was, while holding Cullen up as some bastion of respectability. I mean, he's damn sure not the first trashy millionaire to take a blonde and busty trophy wife, but he still held respect in Fort Worth society. They shunned his wife, but not him. And while Priscilla was indeed blonde, busty, and reveling in her newfound wealth, she is also revealed to be a good mother and a kind friend. One friend said that on the outside, she appeared selfish and spoiled, but in reality, she'd give you a pint of blood if you needed it. And there was something even more sinister about Cullen Davis that came out after a couple of years. He was physically abusive to Priscilla, and also to her daughter Dee, who had chosen to live with her mother. She even took Cullen's last name. In a horrific incident in 1971, a drunken Cullen woke Dee up and marched her to the kitchen. He reportedly said, "What did we forget tonight?" Dee said, "I forgot to lock the back door." Cullen said, "And why do we lock the doors at night?" Dee sarcastically replied, "So nobody will steal your precious junk." I've seen varying reports on what happened next, whether Cullen hit her or shoved her into the door. But in Mike Cochran's book, he said he shoved her into the door, breaking her nose. Priscilla heard the commotion and came running in. Anyone sensitive to violence against animals should skip ahead for about 30 seconds. Priscilla had a new kitten in her arms, and Cullen grabbed the kitten and slammed it to the floor. According to Cochran, the kitten lay there quivering, not dying right away. So Cullen grabbed it and slammed it to the floor again until it was dead. Priscilla and Dee were naturally hysterical at this, and their screams triggered the alarm system, which alerted the police. Somehow, Bill Davis was notified, but he said he didn't want to get involved in Cullen's family drama. But his wife Mitzi did come over and took Dee and Priscilla to the hospital to have Dee's nose looked at. Then Priscilla and her daughter stayed at Bill and Mitzi's lake house for a few days to get away from Cullen. But they eventually returned, and by 1974, there were many incidents of abuse. Priscilla said when Cullen was drinking, he often beat her and kicked her until she was black and blue. He broke her collarbone when they were in Marina Del Rey, and once broke her nose during an argument at the mansion. Around this time, Priscilla broke her ankle skiing in Aspen. While she was on crutches, recovering, she said Cullen once snatched one of her crutches, beating her with it after they had argued. Cullen later didn't really deny the accusations, but said they were exaggerated, and coldly defending himself, saying he could count on one hand how many times he had gotten physical with Priscilla, but quote, "He had good reason." He said his only regret was killing the cat. His violent temper was starting to show more in public, too. At a steeplechase ball, Cullen was waiting impatiently for the valet to bring their car around, and finally, he grabbed the board of keys and threw it in the mud, inconveniencing the other people waiting for their cars. Many of his old friends were there that night and quit speaking to him after this. In January of 1973, Dee came to the mansion with a report card from school. She had tried to change some of the grades, knowing the trouble she would get into with Cullen. But he saw the forgery right away and beat her soundly with a belt. She was 14 years old and ran away that night and stayed at her boyfriend's house. The boyfriend's parents called child welfare, who saw the bruises on Dee, but didn't do much except suggest family counseling. Dee did a somewhat recent interview with 48 Hours in 2017 and explained much of this rather eloquently. She said it was the 70s, and they didn't understand about abuse the way we do today. Though abuse was starting to be studied and informal domestic violence shelters were in a few states, the actual Violence Against Women Act was not signed into law until 1994. As for her mother, she said Priscilla would sometimes defend Cullen, saying, "He loves you. He doesn't mean this." She also said she didn't think her mother had the confidence to live without a man. She does not say this in a judgmental way, just matter-of-factly. Priscilla had been married at 16 and had always remarried quickly when a marriage failed. It is a fair point. I'm going to pause now for a final word from our sponsors. Is there something bothering you? Is it interfering with your happiness or achieving your personal goals? BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. From your phone, laptop, or tablet, you can connect with a professional counselor via text, chat, phone, or video and start communicating with your counselor in under 24 hours. BetterHelp has over 3,000 licensed therapists in all 50 states, treating depression, stress, anxiety, trauma, grief, and other issues that so many of us suffer from. If you're not happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time with no additional charges, and anything you share is confidential. And there is even financial aid for those who qualify. Best of all, it's a truly affordable option. Southern Fried True Crime listeners get 10% off your first month with the discount code Southern. Why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/southern. Simply fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get matched with a counselor you'll love. That's betterhelp.com/southern. It's that time of year when we all start making New Year's goals. We all want to be in better shape, not just lose weight, but practice self-care and achieve personal goals. What if you could use just one program for all your health and weight loss needs? Well, let me tell you about Noom. Noom is not a diet. It's a habit-changing solution that helps you develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. I have found Noom to be so helpful in meal planning, especially when I'm out with friends. I watch my weight and I have high blood pressure, so I need to be careful. Noom has one of the largest and most accurate food databases available, so you can track your meal habits, visualize portion sizes, and check calories at a glance. With the Noom app on your phone, you've got support in the palm of your hand whenever you need it. And we are all busy people, especially trying to get back on our normal hectic schedules after the holiday season. And Noom just asks for you to commit to 10 minutes a day for yourself. Small steps make big progress. So sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/southernfried. What do you have to lose? Visit noom.com/southernfried to start your trial today. Again, that's noom.com/southernfried. It's the last weight loss program you'll need. By the summer of 1974, things had reached a boiling point. On July 30th, Priscilla's 33rd birthday, Cullen packed his bags and moved out. Enraged, she signed a check over to herself for $1,500 and hired a lawyer to begin divorce proceedings. During the next few months, they both started dating other people, though still not entirely ruling out a reconciliation. Priscilla admitted she visited Cullen in his hotel room on several occasions, and they had sex. But she also kept a variety of friends around her at the mansion. I think Dee was right about her not being confident enough to live without a man. But I think it goes further than that. I don't think she liked to be alone. So she took in all kinds of people, some not so savory. There were rumors of drugs and much partying at the mansion, which incensed Cullen, who of course wanted his mansion back. Divorce proceedings in a normal marriage can last a long time. But when there is this kind of money involved, it can last years. Cullen David was reported to be worth $100 million at the time. That would be about $450 million today. And Priscilla wanted half. There was a prenuptial agreement that Priscilla claims she was tricked into signing. but it was evidently worded vaguely, so there was room for a fight. And the fight was on. By 1975, Priscilla had a steady boyfriend named Stan Farr. He was a 6-foot-10-inch tall bearded man who had once been a basketball star at TCU. He was known as a very friendly man, one friend later calling him a big teddy bear. He appears handsome and genial in photographs. He was the manager of a nightclub called the Rhinestone Cowboy. By the summer of 1976, he was living in the mansion with Priscilla, and they had plans to marry. They are a striking couple in photographs, not just for their good looks, but because his 6-foot-10-inch frame towered over the 5-foot-2-inch Priscilla. It's not as though Cullen hadn't moved on himself, though. Just 2 months after he moved out of the mansion, he started seeing a woman named Karen Masters, no relation to his first wife, Sandra Masters Davis. Karen was a former beauty queen, and also a brunette. And though she had a lovely figure, Cullen pressured her into breast augmentation surgery, and she started dyeing her dark hair blonde. It is said that Cullen himself went through a few cosmetic surgeries, tightening the skin on his face. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Karen had 2 sons from a previous marriage, both slightly disabled from a car accident that they and Karen had been in with her former husband. Cullen became close to her boys, and they all lived together. Meanwhile, the divorce with Priscilla was trudging on. The judge on the case, Joe Edson, had temporarily ordered Cullen to pay Priscilla $3,500 a month. As the divorce grew more bitter, Priscilla became more scared of Cullen, hiring private security guards part-time and even having a private detective check out the elaborate alarm system at the mansion. On Monday, August 2, 1976, 2 years into the divorce proceedings, Priscilla went before Judge Edson, asking for another continuance for health issues, as well as an increase in her alimony. She needed to have surgery to remove 2 large masses in her left breast. The judge agreed to the continuance, and he raised her alimony to $5,000 a month. He also ruled that Cullen had to pay her $25,000 for legal fees and another $24,000 for other expenses accrued during the divorce. Many friends later pointed out that with Cullen's net worth, these rulings from the judge would not have really hurt him. He could easily afford the fees as well as the alimony. But these same friends did not see Cullen Davis on the afternoon of August 2nd. No one really knows what his real reaction was. But I think it's obvious that Cullen was petty, and it didn't matter the amount of money, he did not like to lose. He famously did not like to lose at anything. He once broke an ornate billiard stick that Priscilla had gifted him after losing a few rounds of pool at a bar. He took the stick and smashed it into pieces on the sidewalk outside the bar. And there was an added financial stress that many friends didn't know about yet. Youngest Davis' brother Bill had filed a federal lawsuit against his brothers. Aside from Cullen's $16 million in personal debts, he had run up $150 million in company debts. Bill accused Cullen and Ken Jr. of manipulating stock and contract agreements to stop Bill from cashing in on his holdings while they were letting the company bleed money. Cullen was in a meeting with his brother Ken Jr. and their lawyer when he got word of the judge's ruling in his divorce case. Ken Jr. and the lawyer said he seemed to take it in stride. But again, after he left this meeting, his brother didn't see him again. On the night of August 2nd, Priscilla's youngest daughter, Andrea, was spending the night at the mansion. Andrea had always detested Cullen and did not visit much while the couple was together. Her father, Jack Wilborn, had kept custody of her and her brother, Jackie. But she was starting to visit her mother more now that Cullen was out of the mansion. She was 12 years old and a lovely girl. She was an artist and an animal lover, and at 5'7", had already outgrown her petite mother. Photographs of Andrea show a beautiful brunette young girl. Dee was also supposed to have spent the night on August 2nd at the mansion. Her friend Beverly Bass had come over earlier to take Andrea shopping, and the older girls went back to Beverly's house after. Beverly's waterbed had sprung a leak, so they decided to spend the night at the mansion instead. However, they both had dates with their boyfriends, and Dee changed her mind and stayed with her boyfriend. Beverly, always welcome at Priscilla's home, kept her plans to spend the night at the mansion. Priscilla and Stan decided to go out to dinner with friends and then drinks. Andrea knew how to set the elaborate alarm system, so her mother kissed her goodbye and reminded her to set the alarm. Around 12:30 a.m., Priscilla and Stan returned to the mansion. She noticed immediately that the alarm had been disabled and, worried, started looking around the house. She noticed that the door leading to the basement was open, and then she saw a bloody handprint on the doorframe. As she screamed for Stan, a man in black stepped out of the shadows and said, "Hi," and then shot her in the chest, between her breasts, just below the breastbone. She had immediately recognized the man in black as her estranged husband, Cullen Davis. He was wearing a black lady's wig, but his face was uncovered. The gun was covered by a dark trash bag. Priscilla later testified that she heard Stan coming down the stairs and she screamed at him to go back, that she knew Cullen would kill him. Cullen ran towards the door, and as Stan got to the bottom of the steps, he heard Priscilla and slammed the door shut. Cullen tried to push back against Stan, but he was no match for the huge former athlete. So instead, he fired two shots through the door. Both struck Stan. Then he opened the door, stood over Stan Farr, and fired two more bullets into his body as Priscilla screamed. She had been wearing a long denim skirt, and she pulled it up, holding it to the bullet hole as she tried to get up and run. She saw Cullen pull Stan by the feet into the kitchen towards the basement door, and then he stopped and came over after her. She testified that she pleaded with him, "Cullen, I love you. I have never loved anybody else. Please, let's talk. Please sit down and talk with me." He grabbed her by the arms and started dragging her towards the basement too. She said she kept pleading with him and said, "You're hurting me." And he finally let her go, and she slid to the floor. And then he just walked away around the corner of the kitchen. Priscilla said she did get up then and run, holding the skirt under her breasts. She ran outside and said she dove into some shrubbery to hide. She watched Cullen come out of the house, no longer wearing the wig, and open the driveway gate. She then heard voices, and then screaming, and another shot. At this, she jumped and ran. There were about 400 yards between the mansion and the nearest neighbor. Priscilla ran all the way there, barefoot. She had kicked off her high heels in the kitchen before she ran. She finally got to her neighbor's house and rang the doorbell and banged on the door, pleading for help. Her neighbors would later testify that she said, "Please, oh please, help me. My name is Priscilla Davis. I live in the big house on the hill. I've been shot. Please help me. Please, can I come in?" Her neighbors, Clifford and Catherine Jones, were scared and refused to open the door. She again said, "It's Priscilla Davis," identifying herself. "You must call the police," she said. "Cullen is up there shooting everybody. He's killing everybody, and I'm wounded very badly." They assured her through the door that they were calling the police and an ambulance. Catherine Jones said that when they left the door for any reason, Priscilla would start ringing the bell and banging on the door, hysterical, until they came back. They didn't open the door until the ambulance arrived, and they watched Priscilla climb in the back, holding her blood-soaked skirt to her chest. Back at the mansion, it had been Beverly Bass and her boyfriend that had come to the door as Priscilla hid in the bushes, not her daughter Dee, as she had feared. Beverly's boyfriend, Gus Gavril, known as Bubba, saw the open door and told her to stay where she was while he checked it out. But then a man suddenly came through the door. Beverly immediately recognized Cullen Davis and saw he had a gun. She screamed at Bubba to run, but Cullen shot him and then started running after Beverly. She took off as fast as she could. Beverly Bass had run track in high school, and this probably saved her life. She outran Cullen, who finally gave up and moved back towards the house. She finally reached the main road and flagged down a car, begging them to take her to the police and saying her boyfriend had been shot. The man driving the car instead drove her to the nearest phone, where she called the police and told them her boyfriend had been shot. Beverly then begged the driver to take her back to the mansion. "What if my boyfriend has been murdered? What if he's dead?" she cried. He said coldly that if he was dead, there was no need to rush. He said, "Let's wait for the police." But he did go back to the phone and called for an ambulance to be sent to 4200 Mockingbird Lane, the address of the Davis Mansion. Before the police got there, Beverly saw a private security guard and flagged him down, running to his Jeep. She told him what happened and said, "I saw his ugly face." The guard later testified that he said, "Whose ugly face?" "Cullen. Cullen did it," she said. The guard said, "Are you certain?" She said, "Yes, I saw his ugly fucking face." Around this time, the police finally showed up, and Beverly told them the same thing. Her boyfriend had been shot, and Cullen Davis did it. She begged them to take her back to the mansion to see if he was alive. The officers reluctantly agreed and drove Beverly back. At first, they didn't see anything. They are approaching the mansion, guns drawn, with Beverly on their heels. They walk through the door and into the entryway, where on the parquet floor they saw blood, and then they saw Bubba Gavril lying on the floor, his head propped up on the wall. There was a white telephone receiver next to him, smudged with blood. He had tried to call for help, but he was still alive. He arrived at the hospital about 5 minutes after Priscilla. He was more critical than Priscilla and was immediately taken in for surgery before she was. He would be paralyzed from his injury. Priscilla asked the nurses and doctors to call her two best friends. When the women got there, one woman, Judy McCrory, asked, "What happened?" "Cullen shot me," Priscilla said. And then she asked, "Have the police found Stan and Andrea?" Her friends didn't know, but said they would go ask. Priscilla, crying, reportedly said, "Tell them to look in the basement. I think he was trying to get us in the basement." And she was right. Stan Farr was found on the kitchen floor near the basement door, where Cullen had dragged him. And when the police searched the basement, they found the body of 12-year-old Andrea Wilborn. Her eyes were half open, and her face was distorted in pain. She was dead. She had been shot point-blank in her chest, severing her aorta. She had likely been dead by the time she hit the floor. A small mercy. Investigators would take a while to figure out whether Andrea had run down the stairs away from her stepfather, or if she had been marched down there and coldly executed. They have their theories, but it's something no one will ever be sure of. All we know is that a 12-year-old girl, probably recognizing her stepfather, died alone and terrified in the basement of his hideous mansion. And you would think that this heinous double murder would be an open and shut case. Priscilla and Beverly were two eyewitnesses who knew Cullen Davis and identified him separately to the police. Bubba Gavril would also later be able to identify Cullen as the shooter. But Cullen Davis, multimillionaire, hired the most famous criminal defense attorney in Texas history. Hell, and most of U.S. history. Richard Racehorse Haynes. Racehorse Haynes was not only famous for his courtroom theatrics, he was a brilliant attorney who never lost a capital murder case out of the 40 in his career. And this is where Texas prosecutors probably screwed up. They decided to charge Cullen Davis with capital murder. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. The conclusion to the saga of Cullen and Priscilla Davis will premiere next week. You're not going to believe the courtroom antics of Richard Racehorse Haynes and what lengths Cullen Davis would go to for revenge. He actually faced trial 4 times. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify. If you're interested in supporting the show, please visit my website, southernfriedtruecrime.com. There you can sign up to be a patron of the show, make a one-time donation, or purchase show merchandise. That's southernfriedtruecrime.com. And don't forget to check out my YouTube channel. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. Private messages on social media are overwhelming and they often get lost. So email is best. And please feel free to reach out. I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.